It is a very rare achievement that Nathaniel Mackey has accomplished in American literature. An innovative gesture with a dense and yet accessible approach to writing poetry and prose, his work is steeped in jazz rhythms and the improvisation found in that medium, as well as the West African cosmology of the Dogon people, all done with duende, a cante hondo, and almohonda, a deep song and deep soul. His serial poem with two main strands, Mu and Song for the Ondumbulu, take that form to new heights with a rare humility. The latest chapters in the ongoing saga come out this fall with the release of Nod House. Inspired by Robert Duncan and Robert Creeley, among others, Mackey also uses the poem as act of consciousness, as experiment in consciousness. He's author of several books of poetry, including Splay Anthem in 2006, which won the National Book Award. A collection of all the segments so far of his epistolary novel has just been released, entitled From a Broken Bottle, Traces of Perfume Still Emanate. He's also published Criticism, Paracritical Hinge, among those books. He edited the journal Hambone and has been awarded a Guggenheim grant. Nate Mackey, welcome to Seattle.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
It takes a certain amount of courage to write in a way that the mainstream U.S. American writing community would call obscure. Tell us why. What makes you take this risk?
Well, it's a risk that's been taken by many of the authors and artists that have moved me most. And in some way, I'm just doing what seems to me to be the thing to do, which is to try to go to some deep place, both within one's feelings and within one's thoughts. And one does, you know, you run a certain risk of not, you know, speaking to everyone or even not speaking to most people when you do that. But as somebody who has been spoken to by that mode, it, you know, it comes quite naturally for me to pursue it myself.
You know, when I interviewed Victor Hernandez Cruz, he said that poetry has not been marginalized in this culture, but the culture itself, the culture has marginalized itself. Do you does that resonate with you at all?
I'm not sure what he meant by that. You know, it could mean a number of things. To me, it suggests that, you know, the culture has cut itself off from some rather basic human needs, desires, aspirations. And to the extent that poetry, you know, speaks from that place, the culture has marginalized itself from poetry. That, you know, certain, you know, urges that define us as humans. The certainly, you know, U.S. society and the kinds of concessions to a certain kind of capitalist understanding of the world has taken us away from those things.
Some people refer to it as an industry-generated culture.
Well, I don't know if it's that anymore. It seems to be a finance-dominated culture at this point. I mean, it's really, you know, bankers and that kind of thing. You know, the industrial belt is plagued with unemployment, and the industries, the factories are rusting. So it really isn't that anymore. It's something much more abstract than that. When it was an industry-based culture, at least you had the concrete products of industry and labor, et cetera, et cetera. But that that has been marginalized, and that might be another way in which, you know, what Victor was saying applies. That the satisfaction that people get from working and seeing the rewards of their work, that's been displaced by something else. Most people don't have access to it, but the kind of, you know, work that is rewarded is increasingly a kind of speculative, manipulative thing that has to do with numbers and online trading and behind the scenes deals and that kind of thing.
Smoke and mirrors. Now, because of the culture in this country, it has that quality to it that's influenced by commercial interests, maybe more than anything else. Is this part of why you've gone to Dogon culture and Spanish culture and other world cultures or other cultures around the world for inspiration?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, I've been very influenced by, you know, things in the culture of the United States. I mean, that's my first, you know, cultural acquaintance, so to speak. And there were certainly things in there that had a deep influence on me as someone growing up. You know, that's why I've gone to those other places, you know, it's a bit more complicated than some kind of recoil from some kind of impoverishment of U.S. culture. You know, I think it has to do with the fact that, we're more in touch with other parts of the world than we used to be. And growing up, you know, that was a part of my education. That was a part of, this increased availability of the arts and artifacts of other parts of the world. So it would be part of that. And the fact that one has access through, through reading as well as the electronic media would be a part of that as well. I find things in those other places that, that speak to me and that resonate to me. And it's kind of, it's very interesting to me that that's the case, that we are not as, as culture bound in the realm of mind and imagination as we may be in some other ways.
When I think about you talking about U.S. American influences and growing up in Los Angeles, was it Central Avenue where all the jazz was in L.A.? Was that before your time?
That's before my time, and I wasn't in L.A. I was in I was south of L.A. in Santa Ana, Orange County, which is about about a 30, 45-minute drive from L.A. And I didn't really have much experience of live jazz. I began listening to jazz in my early teens when I was in junior high school. One of my older brothers was listening to Duke Ellington and Miles Davis and others, and I started listening to his records, and that got me interested. My contact with L.A., to the extent that I was in contact with L.A., the L.A. jazz scene, was really through radio. There were a couple of, at that point, this was in the 1960s, there were a couple of really great jazz stations broadcasting. There was one called KNOB, the Knob, they called themselves. It was a 24-hour jazz station. And then there was one called KBCA. And it was through listening to them that, I was able to deepen and further, my acquaintance with jazz. I think it wasn't until I was about 17 or so that I actually heard live jazz in a nightclub. And L.A. was one of the places, there were no jazz clubs in Santa Ana or in Orange County, at least none that I knew of. So it meant going to a place like the Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach. There was another place, I can't remember, I think it's long gone now. I think it was called Marty's on the Hill. I remember going there. There was a club that I heard. There was a group that Bobby Hutcherson and Joe Henderson had together for just a second.
That's a Double Rainbow, wasn't it? Around that time of that record.
I don't remember, but they played at a club that I wish I could remember the name of that club. It wasn't there very long, and they didn't have that group together very long. But I remember, and this would have been after high school. This was when I was in college and home for the summer, and I remember going up to hear them. It would have been around 66 or 67, but that was way after the Central Avenue stuff, the historic stuff that you're referring to,
which was the 40s and 50s, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was just getting born in 1947.
Well, I grew up in Chicago, so I know that Central Avenue scene has a resonance for me, but I'm not sure exactly the timeline. Talking with Nathaniel Mackey, he's the author of Splay Anthem and From a Broken Bottle, Traces of Perfume Still Emanate. I'm Paul Nelson. Let's continue that jazz theme. You've talked about rhythm in your work as interrupting a certain uniformity of pace. And what I get from that is like when jazz guys play behind the beat or a little bit ahead of it, playing with the beat. Do you think that adds to your work's perceived difficulty? In other words, most folks are down with a 4-4 time, but you start throwing AACM or Don Cherry kind of time signatures at them and they start getting a little nervous.
Well, first of all, I don't think very much about the difficulty of my work. That's not something that I think it's particularly fruitful to think about poets generally. I think there's been really too much emphasis on the difficulty of poetry. Maybe it goes back to T.S. Eliot saying that modern poetry has to be difficult, and I think that often that that difficulty is manufactured. Often that difficulty is a preconception that people bring to poetry. So I don't tend to think about what makes my work difficult.
But could you talk about the rhythm and talking about how you use rhythm in that way and maybe how listening to jazz might have influenced that?
Well, I know that listening to jazz has influenced it. There are certain things that our environment puts into our minds and into our bodies and in ways that are conscious. Some ways are conscious and some ways are unconscious. I remember reading a comment of Gary Snyder's way back where he talked about doing this kind of work called rip-rap. And in fact, one of his books of poems is called Rip-Rap, and it's some kind of, you know, placing of stones or something like that. But he said that he came to see after doing that work and writing and looking at the poems that came out of that period that the rhythms of that work had very much gotten into his system, so to speak, and that had exerted an influence on the rhythms in the poems. And I think that's true of the things that, you know, we find in our environs. And certainly the kind of listening that I've done to, you know, the music I listen to, jazz being one of them, but other world musics as well, you know, it's gotten under my skin, so to speak, and it comes out in the way that I write and in the way that I read what I write. I don't so much think of it as a conscious deliberative process where I think, oh, gee, a jazz musician would do this, so I'm going to do this in this line. It has kind of flowed out of what I do and what I listen to and what I'm attuned to and even beyond that, other things, the emotional environment one is in, you know, the physiological things that one is going through, you know, whether one is, you know, how old you are or how young you are. All those things, I think, come into play in, you know, determining how one writes. I know you're interested in Charles Olson. I think that's one of the things that Olson was trying to say in the projective verse essay, which is that the body of the poet, the physiology of the poet, is a determining factor in the prosody of the poem. And that, of course, was, you know, a pretty revolutionary statement at the time that he was making it, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, 1950, late 40s, 1950, because American poetry and poetics, thought about poetry, was so dominated by the New Criticism, which really prioritized the poem on the page and didn't even want you talking about the poet's biography or the poet's historical setting, let alone talking about the poet's body, the poet's breathing, that kind of thing. So the kind of rhythmic disposition that you're talking about in my work comes out of a lot of things, and certainly jazz is one of them. And early on, I felt a connection between jazz and the kinds of theorizations that say someone like Olson was doing with the attention to breath, because jazz is a very breath conscious, breath determined music.
And you could also, you know, look at Kerouac talking about Bop's spontaneous prose and a real direct link to bebop. But those two processes have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. When you're writing, you know, you talk about writing, and you don't say to yourself, okay, now insert, you know, Fred Anderson rhythm or Hamid Drake or whatever. But you do, this is what I'm wondering, is it a sound? Is it something you're hearing? I mean, you know, Olson in that essay called it a use of speech, least logical and least careless, and with the ear as measurer. Mm-hmm. So, I'm getting that he's tracking some kind of sound. Duke Ellington said, if it sounds good, it is. So maybe that's a poetics, too.
Yeah, and at one point in the Maximus poems, Olson says, by ear, he said. And I think that he's referring to as Ezra Pound. But yeah, by ear. I certainly, was moved by sound poetry's affinity to music, as Mary Brockes says, that poetry is musicked language, and my instincts were there early on. I heard poetry as something that cultivated the musicality of language, which is not exactly the same as the musicality of music, but that went into and made a resource of you know, qualities of rhythm, duration, qualities such as assonance, alliteration, certainly rhyme, obviously, that are at our disposal in language. But also a certain percussive quality that you can get in language as well. So those are the things that, that interested me in beginning to write poetry and continue to interest me. They continue to be central. Sound, you know, what Pound calls melopoeia, is one of the determining factors. And it can lead one into discoveries on the, at the level of meaning, the semantics of language and of the poem. It can lead one into discoveries with regard to rhythm and prosody as well. So I've been, you know, very, very, you know, moved by that and very motivated by that. And it's probably, you know, I do let my ears lead me. I think one also has to let that come into play with the voice, and that's another thing that Olson talked about in Projective Verse, that you know, T.S. Eliot, he said, had a fine ear, but he hadn't gone down deeply enough into his own throat. And one of the things that, you know, we talk a lot about poets finding their voice, and we usually that's taken in a kind of metaphorical sense, but I think what's, you know, it means something more literal than that. You really have to, you know, find out, you know, what you can do, what your voice can do, and what you want to do with your voice. One of Mary Baraka's early pieces is called "How You Sound," and so finding out how you sound is very important. As a younger poet, when I was just beginning to read poems publicly. In college, I would go to like an open mic thing, and I found, much to my distress, that I had written things that I couldn't read, and that clued me, you know, to the fact that I had to sound the poem out when I wrote it, as I was writing it, and the test is, okay, you just wrote that, you know, how does it sound? Can you read it? You know, if you're having trouble reading it, then that's telling you something.
And it's a tough place to learn when you're in public spitting this poem out, and
tell me about it.
Have to learn it that way. You know, we mentioned Projective Verse a couple of times. I've engaged in a pretty serious study of it since 1995, but I get in a lot of elements of the community who are even aware of the essay. The poetry community, that is. Some folks feel that it's old hat, but yet I get the sense that the possibilities of it have just been, the surface has just been scratched. What do you think?
Well, I don't think it's old hat. You know, you can just, tell by just, you know, the comments I've made so far that it's still a reference point for me. You know, it was a very important, it was a very important moment for me, you know, to read that essay and to become acquainted with the, the poets associated with the Black Mountain College, Olson, Duncan Creeley, at that point, Baraka, Denise Levertov, et cetera. So, and I think there's a kind of, gnomic quality to that essay where it doesn't give up all that is, you know, that resides in it, and you can keep going back to it and pulling things out of it. I'm not sure that Olson himself knew everything that was in that essay, and in that way the essay is something of a poem. And there are some parts in it that are quite riddlesome, and you can tease things out of them and think of it. I've taught courses on Black Mountain poets for years, and it's always interesting for me to see what students make of certain propositions that Olson is putting there. So I think it's still, I think it's still quite vibrant, and I think it's still, old hat. I don't know. Who am I to say? I
mean, well, Miriam Nichols has written a whole book saying that it deserves reconsideration, and I think she may be onto something. And she's discussing many of the poets that you mentioned, and she's also working on the life story of Robin Blazer, mm-hmm. who was also close to that school. You've talked about a kind of poetry which includes, quote, a willingness to reside within a rift of some sort, a blur, a qualification, distinction, or indistinction. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think it's a poetry that is not, you know, that's not so absorbed in or motivated by an attempt to create coherencies, that it overlooks certain, you know, telling fissures and rifts and breakages. Certainly the sense that I was taught when as a student in high school and college is different from that. I mean, the things that when I was in literature classes as a college student, the thing that was extolled when we studied poems, when we studied a short story, when we studied a novel, was the way in which the piece of writing cohered, and the way in which everything was working towards this unified effect. And that was the influence of the New Criticism, because that was the big thing that poems were there for the New Critics, is to give you this unified effect. And there was a certain economy that was privileged, or a sense of economy that was privileged, by that way of looking at the poem, that there's nothing extraneous there, that there's no, in the sense, that there's no wasted motion. And it sounded good, but it didn't jibe with a lot of stuff that was going on. It didn't jibe with a lot of stuff that was going on in, lived experience, both individual and collective. It didn't jibe with a lot of stuff that, that was quite moving and quite impactful in the arts,
As if life were a movie and we can edit the tape before anyone sees it.
Yeah, So the stuff that was, the stuff that was most resonant for me and that was, most meaningful for me was stuff that was acknowledging acknowledging fracture, breakage, fragmentation, things fall apart, and finding a way to, to live with that, to sing it, to even celebrate it, or at least to abide with it. And examples are multiple, and I won't start giving examples. But that's what's behind the kind of statement that you just read that I made.
At least to recognize it and communicate in some way that it exists.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to give an example.
Go ahead. Give one example.
Well, one of the examples that I give that in one of the essays that I wrote, Conte Moro, is from a Sonny Rollins performance where it's on the album East Broadway Rundown, and on the title cat tune towards the end, he actually takes the mouthpiece of the saxophone off of the saxophone and starts playing the mouthpiece, the severed piece of the horn, and that's a literalization of the kind of aesthetic that has informed so much of the music and art that I'm referring to, where you find a way to make fracture tuneful, or atonal even, if it needs to be.
You've also talked about a kind of poetry you said, and this is the quote, certain kinds of wholeness are not available to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certain kinds, are not available to us, or the ones that are available to us are inadequate. They exclude so much, or they are made at the expense of areas of experience and areas of response that are vital and necessary. In one of the pieces that's included in my first book of criticism, Discrepant Engagement, a piece called Sound and Sentiment, Sound and Symbol, or maybe it's Sound and Symbol, Sound and Sentiment. Anyway, it's a subtitle like that. You talk about the idea of predatory coherence, a coherence that is arrived at by preying upon that which does not fit, and either blanking it out, ignoring it, marginalizing it, in some way excluding it, and rendering it null and void. Predatory in that sense. That which doesn't fit becomes a victim of this will to coherence. And the thing that I was trying to suggest in the passage that you quoted is that we have to be wary of the will to cohere, because as we've seen, the will to cohere, certainly in the West, has led to these conquistadorial regimes that just regard, for example, the non-European as irrelevant, you know, to be subjugated or eliminated, but certainly not to be invited in as a vital participant and a source of information about the expansive possibilities of being human. Ralph Ellison says something about this in Invisible Man, you know, I've forgotten how he puts it, but it's something that, the mind that has found an order has to guard against, you know, basically guard against being seduced by that order and being seduced into a kind of a blindness to the things that that order does not accommodate.
And here comes Nat Turner. Watch out. I mentioned that. That came up in the conversation last night. You've categorized the notion of duende as suggesting one is not in command of certain things. It seems to me to have a resonance with Blazer and Spicer's practice of outside, but also with ancient traditions in English poetry, such as Cadman's Hymn. Do you see your work as being a part of the practice of outside?
Yeah, I think that there's a nice, for me, a happy resonance between what Blazer talked about as the practice of outside in referring to Spicer's work and to what the jazz musicians who in the 60s began to break with bebop and not confine themselves to, the harmonic constituents of a piece, in their improvisations, the kinds of things that Ornette Coleman, for example, began to do. And these to play in this way, in this post-bebop way, was to play outside. You played outside the chord changes. And so the kinds of excursions into relative incoherence, incoherent only in relationship to, a certain set of expectations, interested me. And in that sense, I feel aligned with that kind of practice, a kind of excursion into the outside, because of the sense that one is not in complete control and that there are things that extend beyond one's control that are vital and that one has to in some way account for, or at least show a certain amount of respect for.
Be open to. You start doing serial poems called A Song for the Ondumbulu, and you're asking for these kinds of energies. Isn't that a petition to these kinds of energies, don't you think, in a way?
Well, yeah. I mean, Song of the Ondumbulu is a Dogon funeral song that is directed to the spirit world. And the spirit world is the unknown world. I mean, it's and the Song of the Ondumbulu is an admission of limited knowledge. It is an admission of mortality. I mean, it comes in a ceremony that is specifically addressed to mortality. Someone has died. It's also a confession of weakness in a certain way, a confession that one is not in control. So it's that to begin with. In my case, it's an invitation to an other, an otherness, an alterity, in that, one, it's a piece of music that I heard on a recording in, the early 1970s, recording of Dogon music. So it's coming from another place on the globe, another culture in the planet. So it's obviously freighted with a lot of cultural specificity that is foreign to me and that I don't know. It's also, at that time, though I was reading things about Dogon culture and cosmology, Marcel Griault's Conversations with Ogotemeli, neither that book nor the liner notes of the record that I heard this on said anything about the Ondumbulu, other than to suggest that the Ondumbulu are the spirits. It was only in later years, when I read more about the Dogon, that I found out a bit more about the Ondumbulu, that they were this predecessor type of human being that failed, et cetera, et cetera. So I was invoking something that I would later come to know more about. But I was at that point drawn in, you know, by the sound of the music, by certain things, you know, about it. And, you know, moved into an area where I was to be, you know, to be instructed. I was to be given impulses and instruction, and later, you know, more information about that. So, you know, it wasn't a serial poem that I began, you know, knowing as much about where I would go with it as, you know, as I've subsequently come to know. And so in that second sense, it was courting the unknown.
After about 30 years, you start to get some ideas about where it's going. Some ideas.
A few. A few. And, you know, it opens up in all kinds of ways. And you begin to, you know, see things there that you know, you hadn't seen before. For example, the connection between the song of the Andumbulu and Cante Hondo, a flamenco deep song that you've mentioned already. I mean, by the time we get to What Said Seraph, my third book of poems, I was you know, a lot of Spanish stuff, flamenco stuff comes into to the poem at that point. And that had a lot to do with a certain correspondence I was hearing between certain vocal qualities in the singing of the song of the Andumbulu on that recording, a raspiness in the voice, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of flamenco singing, Cante Hondo. So it became a way to navigate myself through a number of correspondences. And, you know, it's come to relate to, you know, different things at different times, but to become a work of accumulation and accretion.
The Andumbulu are described as these progenitor spirits, these spirits yearning to become fully human. In a sense, can we say that we are the Andumbulu?
Well, that's what I've been saying. and I've talked about them as a rough draft of humanity. And I've, you know, come to, you know, identify them with, you know, not with some, you know, exotic, you know, African culture in, you know, in the past, you know, pre-literate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, but to identify them, you know, with us, you know, the species, the human species, and a species trying to become more human, trying to become, to come closer to living up to the ideals that are packed into that word human, humanity, you know, as opposed to inhuman, you know, which we use so often to describe acts that are repugnant to us.
Seems like there's been some slippage in recent years. Maybe that's just the way it always is. Let's talk about one of the poems from Splay Anthem. Your serial poem has two main threads. We've talked about Song of the Andumbulu, and Mu is the other thread of it. I'm thinking of the notion of one of the aspects of Mu you've mentioned is, well, there's the Don Cherry reference, there's the reference to Jane Harrison and Charles Olson's use of the word muthos, and there's also the mythic lost continent, which some call Lemuria. There's a poem in there called On Antiphon Island, and if you could read that, maybe we could talk about it after you read. This is from Splay Anthem, talking with Nathaniel Mackey. He's the author of Splay Anthem and also a new book of prose, a whole collection of his collected epistolary novel, From a Broken Bottle, Traces of Perfume Still Emanate. I'm Paul Nelson.
On Antiphon Island, they lowered the bar and we bent back. It wasn't limbo we were in, albeit we limboed. Everywhere we went, we limboed, legs bent, shoulder blades grazing the dirt, donned Andumbuluous birth shirts, sweat salting the silence we broke. Limboed so low we fell and lay looking up at the clouds, backs embraced by the ground and the ground a fallen wall we were ambushed by. Later we'd sit, sipping fig liqueur, beckoning sleep. Soon come somnolence, nowhere come as yet. Where we were, notwithstanding, wasn't there. Where we were was the hold of a ship we were caught in. Soaked wood kept us afloat. It wasn't limbo we were in, albeit we limboed our way there. Where we were was what we meant by mu. Where we were was real, reminiscent arrest we resisted, bodies briefly had, held on to. A little sonnets, it said on the record. A trickle of blood hung overhead, I heard in spurts. An introvert trumpet run, trickle of sound. A trickle of water lit by the sun, I saw with an injured eye. Captive music ran our legs and we danced. Knees bent, asses all but on the floor, love's bittersweet largesse. I wanted trickle turned into flow, flood, two made one by music, bodied edge gone up into air, aura, atmosphere, the garment we wore. We were on a ship's deck dancing, drawn in a dream above hold. The world was ever after, elsewhere. Where we were, they said lickle for little, lick ran with trickle, weird what we took it for. The world was ever after, elsewhere. No way where we were was there.
You know, when you hear that, and you read the preface, and you get this notion of this lost continent, whether or not it existed, we think, did it exist? I mean, were we taking slaves back then, or is this about Africa? I mean, the mind starts racing with some of the possibilities in hearing something like that and reading something like that.
Only the shadow knows.
you mentioned in an essay on Robert Duncan's war poems, Gesir's Lute, about the notion of a world poem. And is that a more accurate description of what you're trying to do with these two threads? And if so, why don't you describe the world poem?
I don't know if I would call it that, although it certainly comes out of the cross-cultural internationalist impulse that Duncan talks about when he talks about the emergence of what he calls the world poem among certain modernist poets, Pound's Cantos, Williams's Patterson, H.D.'s trilogy. And I see my work related to that. I qualify the term world poem because it does suggest a kind of closure and coherence that, as you can tell by the remarks I made earlier, I'm a little wary of. I don't think that the world poem can be thought of as an achievement. It has to be thought of as an aspiration, and maybe a necessarily failed aspiration. So to the extent that the world poem suggests something that has been achieved and captured, I'm a little, you know, I back off.
Hesitant.
Yeah. But the impulse towards an inclusiveness that goes beyond, you know, certain, you know, accepted or expected boundaries, yes, I'm doing that. I want to do that. I try to do that. And the thing I don't want to be gathered from that is that what I'm doing is inclusive enough to, you know, be touted as some kind of, you know, blending of all of the world's cultures, because it's not that. I have, you know, there are some strands that run through there that I go back to again, and I have, you know, so, you know, I have my favorites. I mean, I'm the Eskimos don't get a lot of play, you know, in my work, and there are all kinds of other places and cultures that don't, you know, that don't show up a lot. Although you'll find, you know, why do the Dogon keep coming up? Why is Brazil such a, you know? So in that sense, it's not a poem that's trying to be encyclopedic in its worldliness. It's the expression of a desire for worldliness, but a desire that goes in certain directions and winds up in certain places in a recurrent way.
Well, certain flavors, maybe gumbo over sushi and what have you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And then, of course, you know, you talk about the world poem, and is that limiting? Because we could talk about the cosmic poem, which includes the other constellations and universes and what have you, or however you want to get into outer space. You've talked about yourself in your work as being a slow improviser, and you say that it rarely comes in one fell swoop, dribbles rather than a river. Can you talk about the balance between the organic, meaning the poem that just comes and you don't even have to touch it, and the revision aspects?
I don't recall any time in recent years that I've written a poem that just came in, you know, one fell swoop. Parts of poems do that. Lines, passages, even extended passages do that. But for one thing, my poems tend to be presented as fragments. Song of the Ondimbulu 35, for example, is being marked as something that is a part of something larger. It's the 35th part of something called Song of the Ondimbulu. But even within that, there will be parts within that part. There will be sections separated by a bullet, or a part separated by a page break and a horizontal line, that kind of thing.
And what does that indicate when you do that?
Well, it indicates that, again, that these are parts, that they are portions of a poem that are coming in at different times, coming in different places. I mean, the placement on the page is trying to suggest something about that. Page breaks are trying to suggest something about that. They're just different ways of segmenting the poem. I think poetry stresses segmentation. Even poems that don't do the kinds of things I'm talking about, the line break is an underscoring of segmentation, especially when you get to poets who actually sound out that line break with a caesura. So there's something at the very heart of the genre that is invested in the cut of segmentality. And in my work, I've augmented that with other means of marking segmentation, segmentivity, or whatever the word would be. The bullet, the page break, the line, the placement of the page on the page. But anyway, that's trying to give some sense of there not being a homogeneous, uniform time and space in which these things occur, even though one can read the poem in a homogeneous, unified time and space. When I read one of those sections, it'll go, if it goes for 5 minutes, you will hear them as though they were all within that space. As far as the process that brought them into being, it's actually much more strung out and staggered than that, both in terms of the amount of time that it takes to read the poem is deceptively compact. And I think that's probably always true with all writing. The process of writing is more strung out. I mean, you read a paragraph that may have taken 3 weeks to write, but it doesn't take you three weeks to read it. So in some ways, this is just highlighting something that's endemic to the medium and maybe medium more generally. But I want to be open to that which comes in, and I do that by keeping a notebook, by writing things down, as they come in, and then, finding out what they may be trying to tell me, finding out where they fit, and the actual, getting the poem together, will come after they've come in. And then there's also the fact that when you sit down to write and to put things together, things happen then too, things that you hadn't planned on. There's been a lot of, thought about that, and there continues to be a lot of concern with and attention to improvisation, and I think that we're just kind of beginning to scratch the surface of what improvisation is. I mean, it's not just spontaneity, which I think it has tended to be confused with. But at the same time, it's something we both give this kind of magical aura, as though it were, really something happening on another planet. And at the same time, it's something very mundane and everyday. I mean, we're doing it right now.
When you drive, you do it.
Yeah, we're doing it all the time. So in some ways, we seem to have, we've put improvisation up against a kind of straw man. I don't know what it would be called, what that straw man is, regimentation.
Formalism.
Organization, formalism. But it's something that we don't tend to achieve. I mean, maybe it's an ideal of control, but we don't have that. It's interesting how hard we think about something that is so commonplace and right at our fingertips. They're academic conferences on improvisation now, scholarly journals devoted to improvisations. I just got the announcement of a new issue of a journal that comes out in Canada. You know, it's the Journal of Studies in Improvisation, things like that. So I always say I'm a slow improviser because I am. I mean, I want to get and we probably all are, but I don't know. Maybe some are faster than others and some are slower than others. But the idea of, you know, that you're just doing what's in the moment and you're going very quickly from moment to moment is probably the dominant picture of improvisation. And it's not the one that, it's certainly not the only picture of improvisation. And I'm trying to get onto the table the idea that there are different kinds of improvisation and different time senses and pulsings of improvisation that are out there and that are possible.
Slow burn,
yeah.
Can you talk to us about the new work coming out this fall?
It's called Nod House. It's a continuation of the serial work, Song of the Andumbulu and Mu. It's a, I think that it, Splay Anthem ended with Song of the Andumbulu 60, and this one goes from 61 through 85. I've forgotten what the corresponding Mu numbers are. The title suggests a kind of somnolent state, a kind of half dream, half waking, Nod House, but also the other sense of the term nod, which is the giving of assent to something, and in a conscious way, and sometimes in an unconscious way. So various senses of nod are at play in the book. There are two sections. Part one is called Quag, and part two is called Quag. And Quag is described, characterized at one point as Nub's new colony. Nub was the final section of Splay Anthem, and it was the name, a very polysemous name for a place, a condition, et cetera, et cetera. And it wanted to suggest a certain kind of diminution and crisis. And Quag comes out of that. And as you can hear in just the term itself, it suggests a predicament of being stuck. And the fact that it's repeated, that it's the name for the two sections, suggests a kind of stasis, a kind of being stuck. And Nod House is in some way exploring the inner recoil in search of some kind of spiritual nutrients, I guess I should say, plural, that we go through in that condition of stasis and crisis, critical stasis. And the book is following through with those two serial poems and the intertwinement of them, Mu and Song of the Andumbulu. And it essentially continues the work I've been doing for these few decades, and you know, comes out of Splay Anthem in the way that you know, in the way that I've suggested, but probably in some other ways as well, and opens up into new things as well.
When you say the word quag in USA in 2011, we see the two quagmires that are going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how these have been described by critics as Vietnam in the sand. So is there a nod to these quagmires in what you're doing?
Yeah. You know, writing out of a sense of that backdrop, seemingly unending backdrop of war that we've been involved in. And in fact, I think there are a few lines at one point that go something like, quags, ash, falling for ages. And, you know, how to live with that, you know. And I think part of it is this inner recoil that I've talked about, you know, falling back away from it into oneself. One of the motifs that recurs throughout the book is just the phrase, what soul was. There's a poem in which that's called Day After Day of the Dead. And it says at one point, nobody wanted to know what soul was. So the project and the challenge of soul making in the face of these very, you know, inauspicious external events that just seem to be there unremittingly, seem to be the quagmire we find ourselves stuck in, is one of the things that I think the book is some expression of, you know, and some response to, and it seems to be a test for us, you know. It seems to be a test for us to have to live with these conditions, as previous generations have, as we know from, you know, world literature, world music. These kinds of trying situations have been, the bane of human existence for quite some time now, and it's our turn.
These endless violent occupations. You mentioned this notion of soul making. It reminds me of Keats, how this planet is a veil of soul making. And for the poet who, and my assumption is that the poet is a person who is seeking a deeper consciousness, having a backdrop of endless violent occupations, if we can see it through the lens of Robert Duncan and your essay on his Vietnam War poems, Gassier's Loot, we get a sense that while they are trying times, it's an incredible opportunity for a poet in these kinds of times.
Well, it's an opportunity to be more conscious of the not so obvious dimensions and ramifications of war. That it's not just out there. One of the things that Duncan wrestled with was the way in which one of the slogans during the Vietnam War period was bring the war home, and one of the things that Duncan sort of implicitly and sometimes explicitly insisted on was that the war already was at home. And one of the things that the poet can do is to point that out, is to throw light on that. And that's one of the things that Duncan was doing in his poems of the Vietnam War period. And it's something that poets are often perceivers of direness, and sometimes it's difficult for our society to see the relevance of poets and their predilection for perceiving direness. And sometimes when times of external manifest calamity and crisis occur, it's a bit easier for the society to see the relevance of things that the poets have been saying. And in some ways, Duncan is talking about that in his war poems. He's talking about it in the H.D. book when he writes about H.D. and her war trilogy. H.D. talked about it in the war trilogy. And I think it's an opportunity, if that word doesn't rattle too much, that's met with mixed feelings. So the way in which expression becomes angled and graded and textured and nuanced and complicated in the work of somebody like Duncan becomes another way in which one sees the conflict and contradiction and manifesting itself in the work itself. But and in Duncan's view, and I think in my view too, that the translation of that into some kind of counterpoint, some kind of musical apprehension that allows one to let these different things have their moment and slide and having their moment and move through one another in the ways that they need to, and in that way it's an attempt to become more capacious in what we can let be and let speak to us.
It's been a real honor and pleasure to have you in Seattle, and I hope that you'll visit again soon. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.